All right, welcome to this edition of the Justice Team podcast. And today we will be talking about the $161 million verdict against Suzuki on a product liability case with punitive damages and the wild story how it got there with practical how-tos. First, we got the two lawyers that were in the courtroom trying it. The third lawyer that's doing all of the law in motion, Travis Davis, was traveling, couldn't be here, but he can get a little behind the scenes with more of the nitty-gritty stuff. But first, I want to introduce to you Mr. Gabe Houston from the trial lab that's based in Florida and also California. He's bi-coastal. Bi-coastal. Gabe, Bye. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Bob. I'm proud to say I am bi-coastal.
Yeah, bi-coastal. And Robbie, who is just on the left coast most of the time. Robbie Munoz, who is a... How long have you been licensed, Robbie?
This is month 12.
So 12th month.
12 months.
So Robbie only gets...
Wait, what?
Yeah, I tricked you.
Whoops. Yeah. Robbie only gets 9-figure verdicts. You had some 6 and 7s and 5-figure verdicts, you know.
That's rookie of the year stuff, I think.
It is rookie of the century. Yeah, so, you know, Robbie's a lawyer in our office, and he tried a few cases as a law clerk, actually. Interesting story. But, you know, we want to go back.
Stop him, Matt?
Yeah, yeah.
He actually helped me try a case before he was even a law student.
Really?
I had a 6-week med mal trial in Riverside, and he sat at counsel table with me, went into chambers with me, was solicited for information from the judge before he was even a law student.
Wow.
Yeah. This before law school.
Before law school.
I guess that was my very first experience at counsel table.
That's right.
So.
Well, there you go.
You get credit for that.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so, you know, Gabe, you know, man, how is this is a 2013 crash, right?
Correct.
How does a 2013 crash end up into 10 years later getting tried?
This is products liability, man. You know, corporations, they don't roll over. It's not a single event crash. You know, one thing that I've talked to, you know, Robbie about a lot was the difference between this event or this case and a typical Simon Law Group case, for example. A lot of Simon Law Group cases that Robbie's working on are single event cases, a collision at an intersection between two individuals. This is a corporation and they have deep pockets and they have other litigation across the country that I'm working on some of that and have been since 2015 or so. And they know, it's even in their documents, we're not going to pay out on any of these. If we ever do, it'll go out on the web and we'll get the reputation for this.
And you saw some of those actually in the documents in this case.
Correct. Absolutely. Yeah. It was all part of the discovery that we uncovered and we translated the documents. And it was clear as day that their motivation was, we are going to fight. And if we lose, we will appeal. And if we lose, we'll appeal again. And we'll try and get it back to a
trial. Truly, there is no honor in defeat.
Absolutely. It's I've said it a bunch of times.
I did a 6-week product trial against Honda one time. It was kind of a similar thing. And the one thing that I was just blew me away from the single event, which most of the stuff that we do at our firm, is how much money they spend on experts and how much you're up against. You know, and I know in that trial they paid one expert alone $2 million, just on one. You know, so, I mean, how expensive are these types of trials that you're doing? And you had it for 10 years.
Yes. Well, nobody knows how expensive it is more than Simon Law Group. So, and you know, on a handshake, Brad and I had a conversation with Conger, right?
Yeah, Conger and Jenny.
I did a clopening. I call him a clopening. I presented Brad.
Clonopin?
No, different.
Different. I would never picture Gabe Houston to be on Clonopin. If you meet Gabe Houston, the guy's definitely not on any type of chill pill.
Wow, the pump started early. Yeah. I did a clopening for Brad and Conger in the Seal Beach office where I presented the documents that I had and what I believed I could show to establish the punitive damages. And from there, it was literally a handshake of, I need help and I need money. And
when was that?
That was when I left the previous firm I was in. So that would have been in January 2018.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, so, okay. So walk us through this. How did this take 10 years?
So this crash occurred in 2013. The attorney who handled it at first was a family friend of the client. Mm-hmm. And it was really just a demand letter. There was a 1530 policy. So he made a demand for the policy. They didn't pay it. He immediately filed a complaint and then they paid it before he even had to serve it. So then he got notice sometime after that, about 8 months, 10 months later, there was a notice of recall on this part. And then he referred it to me like, hey, do you want to take a look at this potential product case? So that would have been in early 2015. So I filed it June 1st, 2015. Mm. asked for discovery in that case as soon as I filed it, and I was stonewalled by defense on basic discovery things. And I
thought, so who are the defendants? Educate, who are the defendants in this case?
The defendants in this case that I filed against was Suzuki Motor of America, Inc. and Suzuki Motor Corporation. So anytime you have an acronym with an A in it, it means America. Mm-hmm. Suzuki Motor of America or American Suzuki Motor Corp. There was a bankruptcy issue that converted one to the other. It's sort of complicated, but I think it was a bankruptcy intended to avoid liability for this case. And there was some evidence to establish that that was actually their motivation all along. But it was against Suzuki Motor of America, Inc. and Suzuki Motor Corp. and Burt's Mega Mall, which was the retailer that my client bought the motorcycle from, used, previously owned. And Suzuki Motor Corp, defense for Suzuki Motor Corp, assumed the defense of Burt's Mega Mall.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So that all ended up being... So who ended up being the actual defendant that's the one that if they're going to pay is going to pay the judgment? It would just be Suzuki.
Suzuki Motor Corp Japan.
Yeah.
Correct.
All right. So filed in 2015, getting stonewalled. You know, you, Gabe Houston, you do product, complicated shit. Product liability, aviation.
Med Mal at the time.
Wow.
Right.
Do you do bird law?
If I can find coverage... And I can get them served.
Carrier vision service.
So it's funny you say that because I've never had a trial that was a four-day trial.
Oh.
All my shortest trial is 3 weeks. I've never been in a trial for less than like 15 trial days. And I envy the Simon Law Group and Robbie when he's like, I have a four-day auto case. It's like, what? Will you get a jury before lunch? Right? Yeah.
Jury before lunch, right. Before Friday.
Or admitted liability. Oh, I've never had anybody admit liability on a single trial I've ever had. Not once.
Wow.
Not one time.
All right. So 2015, you file stonewalled. I mean, there's been talk about the actual stuff you discovered in these documents and how it led to punitive damages. Can you kind of walk us through how you did this?
So let me say, this was not an individual effort, okay? So very early on, once I was able to obtain the discovery documents early, they provided me 305,000 pages, documents of discovery, all in Japanese.
Ooh, that was my first introduction in the case.
So Robbie was working with me at the firm at that time. And I said, Robbie, help me with this, right?
Robbie, a little baby law clerk.
Right.
Law clerk before law school, yeah.
And
he was young and innocent then.
Through these documents, I was able to find other litigations throughout the United States. And I picked up the phone and I found this guy in Kentucky. I'm happy to give names. I'm not giving names. It's just, it could end up being a lot of names. But one name I need to mention is a guy by the name of Paul Pyland. He's in Atlanta. I found this group of litigation, this group of litigations, if you will, and I contacted them and I got the warmest reception. They said, man, we've been looking for somebody like you and people to join this. Mm-hmm. So we established this consortium nationwide from Georgia, Mississippi, Kentucky, Florida, Texas, California, and there might've been some others north of that.
The Bay Area back down.
And we all worked together. We all shared theories. We shared documents that had been transcribed or translated, I should say. And we just started working together, sharing experts. And that began the process of, okay, this is bigger than what I think. This is a big case. And it has wider ramifications. And that's sort of what motivates me as a lawyer. It's like, I don't want to say not interested in the one-off case, but I'm interested in the more global application. Something that my efforts with my team can make a bigger difference.
So fast forward to now after, you know, you had this landmark verdict, finally holding them accountable with punitive damages. What do you think there's future ramifications for Suzuki and others that were wronged by this product?
So that was one of the themes of our case. And I didn't even get to answer your previous one. I'm sorry, my long-windedness. But the themes of our case is that they recalled this product finally after a 9-year investigation that was throughout their documents and throughout their investigation. They repeatedly said things like, this is a matter that involves human lives. It's a recall matter. Prioritize it. And they didn't want to disclose the information to the federal government or to the people because they would tarnish their brand. It would tarnish their sales. And then finally, they couldn't deny the defect anymore. And they finally recalled this product in 2013, 9 years.
Wow.
And Joey, in that period, Joey, my client, bought his motorcycle. Can I lay out a quick timeline?
Yeah, let's do it. All right.
So it starts in 2004, but I'm going to jump ahead to about 2009. Okay, so 2004 to 2009, they're starting to get wind of this defect that's a product involving the front brake of a motorcycle that provides 80% of the braking power of a motorcycle. The number one safety issue or safety feature of a motorcycle is front brake. So jump forward to 2009, they're starting to get clued into what's going on. But then let's forward to 2011. Now they know they have a problem and they start thinking that we have to change the design and something else is going on inside. By 2012, they say we need to capture these motorcycles before somebody manipulates them because we lose data in our investigation. How are we going to capture them? And they decide, well, we can't just issue a bulletin because then we'll have to notify NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Then we're screwed. Mm-hmm. So their documents, even, I'm not making any of this up. I can show you with their documents that they say this. We can't do this because then we'll have to notify NHTSA. In 2011, 2012. So by 2012, they send a guy over by the name of Kudo. And Kudo comes and he goes to Burt's Mega Mall, which is where Joey bought his bike, right? And they go and there's like 20 or 30 of these bikes on the line and they start squeezing brakes. They don't even tell the management of Burt's that they're coming, right?
What?
So Kudo and this other guy, Steve, from the American distributor.
Kudo and Steve.
Kudo and Music. They start squeezing brakes and they find 2 out of 20, 10% of these brakes are bad.
And they can tell right away.
They can tell right away. They squeeze right to the handlebars. And then they go right into the office and they tell the management of Burt's Mega, oh wait, that's not what they did.
They went to Japan
and they told the Japanese headquarters that's what happened. They, in their own documents, say we did not tell Burt.
kept them in the dark.
And they're still, they sold those two.
Hold on. So then, yes, they probably sold them. But then Japan says, hey, can you get those bikes from Burt's? And Steve says, that's going to be hard to do because we told Burt's there was no reason, there was nothing wrong, even though for 9 years they knew about it, right? So then they're like, how do we get these parts without alarming people? I know what we'll do. Let's do a springtime service sales event.
What?
Where we'll bring people in and we'll get their information so we have updated information. We'll squeeze their brakes. We'll try and sell them stuff and make money. But in the meantime, we're going to find out what's going on with their brakes. Called, and in their documents, called a capturing activity.
Right. How they capture back his brakes on it.
So, and that was all in spring, just before Joey buys his bike. And then Kudo writes a memo. And in his memo, he says things like, if we don't do a recall and it comes to light, we're going to be forced to give documents and they're going to show concealment of our investigation. Concealment's in there. And they have this, they give us a beautiful chart of risks and benefits of doing a recall and not doing a recall. Right? And it's right there, man. It's right there.
And it's in front of the jury.
And it's in front of the jury. And there's an article attached to it that says, if we don't do a recall, we're going to get fined something like what happened to Toyota, which was $33 million because they didn't do a recall on their stuff. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at the industry to decide what they should do. And like
really proper. Doing like a safety cost benefit analysis. Should we risk people dying over paying a penalty?
Profits over people. Classic profits over people. So all this comes in. And then Joey buys his bike in May. 2013, rides it for 500 miles over 10 days, and then crashes, tragically injured. And then 4 months later, they announce a recall, magically fixing the design and the manufacturing problem that they'd known about for 9 years and really specifically knew about for at least 2 to 4 years. And it was a very difficult issue to discover. In all reality, it was tough for them to figure out what it was. But they knew by January of 2013 that the defect was internal and it needed to be fixed and it was a recall matter. And they still waited another 10 months to even announce.
What type of bike are we looking at here?
The Suzuki GSXR model of motorcycles, the 600, the 750, and the 1000 from model year 2004 to 2013. However, their recall that was announced in October 2013 only fixed the design, not the manufacturing defect. So it's still available. It's still defective to this day. And that's not an opinion. That is a fact that our metallurgist, Ramesh Kaur, determined by evaluating a pre-recall and a post-recall. Corrosion is in these things to this day.
So is it the same models or is it later models
too? Same models. And I'll tell you, earlier this year, the Suzuki Hayabusa, which is a GSXR 1300, had a recall announced on a brake sudden lockup, which was a symptom throughout all of our documents that occurred as well. So I'm telling you, this is a continuing problem. Suzuki has denied from the stand. They repeatedly said a defective front brake is not an issue of public safety.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
How is that even?
Jury didn't like that.
They didn't like that one.
I mean, when you heard that broadly, I mean, do you ride? Are you?
I don't. No, I never have.
Grave does.
I did for a long time.
Yeah. So whenever you hear, how many of your jurors were actually rode motorcycles?
One guy rode a motorcycle every day.
Yeah.
He was riding a Honda CBR every day to trial.
So, I think in total we had four riders on our panel.
And including a woman. Correct. A woman was a rider.
So you had to see visible reactions when they said that. Yeah.
There were certain reactions about riding that their defense, they hated their accident reconstruction. And one of the things I took, their little model, and I did an endo with it. And he's like, that can't happen. I go, this can't happen. If you stump on the front brake, bike flies forward. He's like, no, that can't happen. And then there was like five jurors laughing.
Yeah. Shaking their heads laughing. That was probably the greatest reaction out of the jurors.
I always say, like, you don't know how strong you're, the jurors are with you until you get to the defense case,
right?
And they start asking questions.
You start to see their
because they're told that's wait till we hear the evidence. Wait until you get to our side, and then they hear their side. They're like, that's it.
Yeah. The nodding comes.
Even in close, okay. One of the things I did in the punitive damages close was throughout the course of the trial, Robbie worked up the damages on this, and one of the element of damages was the 10% chance that Joey loses his leg above his knee, and above the knee amputations, as you know, is much worse than a below knee, but 10% chance, and it was so de minimis to Suzuki when they would argue it's a 10% chance, and all this stuff has to go wrong for this to happen.
Right.
So in punitive damages, right? So now the jury's already given me permission to ask for punitive damages. So I already know they're on my side, on our side, right? So in punitive damages, I say, you know, when I put up $1 billion on the screen, which is an astronomical number, I had to take a breath before I did it. I was like, okay, we're going to ask for $1 billion in my head. Like, this is a big number. And I said, I want to talk about $1 billion. But before I get there, let's talk about their total sales number and take 10% of it. And their total sales for the year was $33.7 billion in sales per year. Hmm. So I said 10% of that is $3.37 billion. Now, Mr. Defense Attorney argued that a 10% chance of losing his leg was so small of a chance as to not be really all that practical or relevant or even important.
Concerning, right.
And I said, concerning. I wonder if they're going to have the same enthusiasm when it comes to losing 10% of their profits.
It was beautiful.
I saw a juror, they went like this. They looked over and was like, good point, dude.
Yeah.
You can't have it both ways,
right?
And it was those kind of things like you're talking about. By the time the case got to the defense, it was over. And I had told Robbie that.
It was too late. And you could see it.
And I think a lot of what people don't understand is it's not like you have an opportunity to resolve these cases.
Right.
Like,
this was going to sand.
Me have an opportunity?
No, them.
Well, they could have. Sure.
No, I mean, they're never going to give you a real offer.
Correct. To this day, they still haven't.
Yeah.
And they've showed no interest in trying to resolve this case.
Appeal, do everything they can for 100%.
Right. 100%. And that was, I think, one of the interesting things about this trial was from day one, there was already reference to the appeal, right?
From like the judge.
Day one. And from defense counsel.
Correct.
Like everything that was being done was like, well, for the eventual appeal. Well,
and that's what you have to, lawyers don't realize is you can go get verdicts in these cases, but as an awesome plan, you got to be perfect.
Correct.
Right.
You got to be perfect.
Right.
So talk to us about that imperfection, even though this is the second verdict you had in this case.
Correct.
Talk to us about what happened the first time, what changes that you guys made. We'll get to Robbie's story in a second about the damages. Yeah. But I'm talking about just generally a first trial and then what the appellate court said you had to change and how that factored into decision-making for the second.
Yeah, man, that's a very complex, that's a deep question. Deep. And it's, in the first trial, I tried a tactic and I tried it with I asked for your help and you guys gave me another attorney to try the case with. And in fairness, that attorney wasn't really up to speed in all of the nuances of this case. So I tried the heavy lifting, and that attorney did most of the damages witnesses. It was in his wheelhouse. But that case, we didn't have a metallurgist to talk about the deep science of what was happening inside this brake that was the corrosion. I elected to prove it through Suzuki's own investigation. Ultimately, the appellate court said that wasn't good enough. I didn't link the causation between what they call the recall condition and my client's collision. So the appellate court overturned the entire verdict on causation, lack of causation. But they also did some other things that I was able to keep out the police report on the first one. They said that was wrong, and some other things came up. But ultimately, it was the lack of causation.
But they gave you a roadmap to essentially cure what they're likely going to hear later.
That's right. They gave it. They basically said, if you can cure the causation, then you get a new trial. If you can't, you're out. You should have been thrown out on JNOV. Mm-hmm. And we basically, through Travis Davis, Simon Group, wrote, basically were able to provide an offer of proof to the court, granting us that the court ended up granting us a new trial. So we're remanded for new trial at that point.
Listeners don't understand, like, if you need to have like law and motion department with you side by side and hand by hand to have these, to have like, it's so perfect because this is what you're up against. You know, you're getting appealed on every little sentence you say, every piece of evidence that you put in. So first, explain to us first what a metallurgist is and what liability types of experts you had.
Okay. So metallurgy, this case, let me describe, it'll be easier to do it that way. This case involved what are called dissimilar metals, two different types of metals making direct contact with each other in the presence of an electrolyte, which is short version for a battery. That's all a battery is. Two different metals in an electrolyte.
So it's not like death metal and hair metal hair bands?
Zinc and iron.
Gotcha.
Zinc and iron, right? And the electrolyte is brake fluid that had water in it, deteriorated brake fluid. Those things make direct contact in brake fluid. It's a battery. It starts throwing off electrons, okay? And the byproduct of that is a corrosion gel that has hard particles in it, but it also has hydrogen that's created. So that's the manufacturing defect, because there was a coating that allowed some of this to happen. The design defect was the fact that there was, like, if you think of a chimney doesn't stick out of the side of your house. It sticks straight up because air rises to the top. Well, in this case, there was a vent that was out to the side, and it allowed gas to gather above the level where the vent would allow gas to purge. So when I said before they didn't fix this problem, all they did in the recall was change the chimney from the side to the top. They didn't fix the dissimilar metals. It's still there to this day. The metallurgist came in to talk about that process called galvanic corrosion and how that occurs and what that byproduct is.
You have to essentially teach science to 12 strangers.
That's what I've always done. MedMal's the same way. You got to teach medicine to them. Back injuries, you got to teach medicine to them with disc problems.
And you got to know it. I mean, Gabe, you know your shit. Like, you could probably do a whole fucking, write a book about this type of issue.
Galvanic corrosion,
For sure. I think that was, you know, something that we always had to be aware of throughout the trial was, you know, who's with us, who's paying attention, who's really getting this, and breaking it down to its like most simple form, I think is the easiest way to do that.
But analogies always, okay. Yeah. So yes, they're complex, but I always come back to real world examples that people understand. And in medicine, I did the same thing. I see other lawyers, and maybe this is a teaching moment, other lawyers get so complex with this stuff. Maybe it's for their own ego to show how much they know and how smart they are with science. I'm the other way. I dumb it down to something so stupid. Like
the
windshield wiper.
Yeah.
Okay. So in this case, there was like a seal disruption issue where the seal has to build pressure so that it can force fluid down and squeeze a brake. And to you, your head might be spinning right now. What I used was a pine needle underneath a windshield wiper. Okay. Everybody, or a leaf underneath the windshield wiper. Your windshield wiper is wiping and you have a good seal and it clears the water off your windshield. And then you get a pine needle under there and it doesn't work anymore, but it's still going back and forth, but you're getting streaks now. And then it ejects the pine needle and starts working again. Everybody has seen that analogy in life, right? That's what happened in this case. A seal disruption caused a sudden unexpected failure of this brake, like a pine needle under a windshield. And people were like, boom,
that
I get
makes
it.
Sense.
Yeah, I get we just it. Kept, you know, he was repeating that throughout the trial, and you could see eventually these jurors come around like, okay, like, I got it.
Yeah, so this case, for our listeners, this was tried in Orange County, California, which people believe is a more conservative venue and harder on damages and these types of things.
And North Orange County specifically.
Yeah, so absolutely more.
Even, harder. Yeah.
So, you know, first trial, I think it was around $1 million for the injuries to Joey, and then $8 million-ish for
6.8.
For punitive damages.
Correct.
Right. So now we're looking at, it was $11,005,000 for the injuries to Joey.
Right. Correct. Correct.
And exactly. $150 million for punitives.
Right. Correct.
Right.
How did that change?
Mm-hmm.
So, well, one in damages, but the difference was how we approached it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Robbie, I'll give it to him in a second here, but the real key here, which gave us the indication that things were very different this time, was in the first trial, it was $800,000 in compensatory, the damages to Joey, and 6.8 in punitive. This, and there was also a comparative fault, where they attributed 48% fault to the driver of the SUV that cut Joey off in the first trial. In this trial, there was zero comparative. 100% on Suzuki. Right. Zero to the SUV. And what we adamantly argued throughout trial was, with the time and distance he had to stop at the distance he was when he saw the bike, or when he saw the car come out, and his speed, he had time to stop without heroic efforts, without locking up a brake. Yeah. So the driver, we argued, caused the exigent circumstance, the sudden emergency, but didn't cause the collision. The failure of the brake caused the collision. I think we did a better job of establishing that.
For so, sure. I mean, it's almost like a very expensive focus group for the first trial to figure
out. That and we did an actual focus group.
Right. That, like, I did. So, we did multiple focus groups,
that,
actually.
So that, I think the last focus group we had, really, we walked away from that and both thinking like, wow, number one, we were about to go down this path that we thought we'd figured out and like we've got this nailed in. And then we have this focus group and we're like, shit, you know, we have to rethink our strategy here, because the way that they're hearing and listening to this client's own story is not coming off the way we want it to, because we shared, you know, his injuries and what he went through and visible injuries.
So get to your part though too. Like the damages part was different. Robbie handled the damages much different than round one. Right. And that was a key element in getting that 11 versus 800.
So what are his physical damages?
Sure. So physically, after this crash, he, you know, his kneecap essentially explodes and it's in a ton of different pieces. He has a femur fracture, and then his left ankle is fractured. It's the right knee that goes through the most. So five surgeries over about a year and a half. And when I say five surgeries, I don't mean like one first surgery and then like, you know, some minor revision. They have to reopen his knee five different times. And I really dove deeply into drawing that out, so much to the point where we had a juror get to sending a note to the clerk saying that she was getting nauseous from our animations.
You're glossing over the injury.
Yeah,
the
I'm gonna
kneecap is a problem.
Right.
So, and like the mafioso movies where they say, I'll break your kneecaps. Yeah. There's a reason they say that, because it'll never heal right.
Right.
When you have a broken patella, you can't fix that very well. And that person's always gonna walk with a limp. And then they can tell who the rats are. Right. That's the whole purpose of the movie.
Oh, you know, I never knew that.
Right. Yeah. And I didn't know that either.
We learned that from Dr. Hatch. Dr. Hatch. His primary care, like his treater. Right. So that, and Joey has this obliterated kneecap. Right. So he's got a leg length discrepancy. Go ahead.
Right. And I'm, so first surgery, they're trying to fix that kneecap, right? So they go in there, it's a traumatic surgery. They fix it up, they suture it. And then about a handful of months later, it starts to freeze up, starts to lock up on him. They're trying to take him back in there to now free up some movement, some scar tissue. Patella refractures. So at that point, and now he's going through physical therapy after this, and they, you know, stitch him up for the second time. He's going through physical therapy and the physical therapist is trying to get some more movement out of that knee, snaps his patella tendon. So they got to take him back in for a third time. So they reopen it a third time. Jeez. Now they're putting cadaver tissue in there. They're trying to get this patella tendon rebuilt.
Demoralizing for the psych too.
Oh, I mean, and we're tracking this all the way through, right? Like the mental effect this is having on him, the effect it's having on his whole family unit at the same time, which we're able to draw in through the damages witnesses. So fourth surgery, he finds, and I thought this was really compelling. His mom was smart enough to think about trying to find the best surgeons in Southern California.
Keeping in mind, they were going to take his leg.
Correct.
They were going to cut off his leg.
Was a major.
In the day after the collision, they were going to take his leg off.
Well, how do you, when you say, well, that's, you know, that didn't happen. That's damage that you can't prove. They may have just taken his leg. How do you get that in, counselor? What relevance does that have?
Well, so for jury instructions 3095, I think, non-economic damages, one of those items that's listed out, well, not one, we went through about like 20, but grief, anxiety,
mortification,
fear, humiliation, all of these different emotional injuries that attach themselves to hearing, hey, you might lose your leg, or we were already debating taking your leg off. And then, you know, throughout this entire process, him wondering, am I better off just amputating this thing? I mean, it got to the point where he's going through so many surgeries, so much treatment. He's literally, you know, arguing with his mom about, should I just died in this crash or should I just have this leg amputated?
And you got all that into evidence.
Yeah, through the damages witnesses.
So how did you use the damages witnesses in this case? Did it differ from the first?
Masterfully, Robbie did it. I'm telling you, he did it small chunks.
Some of that, you know, we were talking about not overloading this jury, and Gabe gave a really good suggestion early on, which was, you know, keep it smaller for each of these damages witnesses, but make it impactful. So I came up with this idea.
And touch on different areas of damages.
Yeah, right. Always touch upon different area, right? So
we're not being redundant. For listeners, damages witnesses or family or friends or coworkers that see and observe different types of things going on in the plaintiff's life.
They're experiencing it. They're with the plaintiff. You have to make sure that the testimony is not cumulative. So you're trying to find different areas of harm.
And nobody likes a groveling plaintiff. Likes somebody who's going to complain about their life.
I mean, is that something that you had to deal with that, you know, look in your focus groups, they wanted to hear it from other people rather than from the plaintiff?
Right. So,
but there's a different issue to that too. Joey, he had hidden injuries and he looks fine and he acts fine and he's worked his whole life to get back to fine, so you don't know that he has a problem.
I heard he was snowboarding and doing some
skateboarding, snowboarding, all sorts of stuff. So if you ask Joey and you look at Joey, he looks great. So we had to get the damages out from other people who knew he wasn't great.
Right. Right? And he's this person that tries to do everything he can to move past this. He doesn't want to live with this and make it seem like he's injured and he's harmed. And he wants to be a strong individual who overcame this stuff. So going back to that space was really difficult for him. And that was a challenge between him and I throughout the preparation of this trial. But going back really quick, so fourth surgery, you know, they find the specialist. His mom finds a specialist. He goes in there, redoes the entire thing, revises the entire knee. He's then, you know, sutured up again, and one of his sutures starts to weep, and they realize, okay, there's an infection inside.
No.
So they've got to open this thing up a fifth time. So throughout trial, we're talking about how this guy has constantly, you know, had these five different major surgeries on this knee. And these jurors are like, this is insane, right? Five different times. So going back to the damages witnesses, how do you draw that out? How do you make that resonate? So I came up with this idea of asking each of the damages witnesses to give me a word to them that described Joey. Mm-hmm. And then tell me why that word. And then the third piece, it was just one, two, and three, right? Give me a word, why that word for Joey. And then what's a memory that really defines his recovery experience for you, that's specific to you and your time with him? And we were just getting these like incredible answers. Our very first damages witness was his sister, his little sister, who at the time was 12 years old. She's 12 years old and she grows up in an instant. I mean, she's
changing bedpans, taking him to the bathroom.
Like, right, putting him on the toilet, pulling him off the toilet.
Mind you, these are witnesses that Robbie put on for 15 minutes.
Right.
15 most minutes, powerful most yeah. powerful yeah. ones ever.
I mean, they this first crazy. Witness, we talked about this, like we're both trying not to cry during this first witness.
So that's hard because, you know, when I do those, I can't look.
Yeah.
I can't look at the person test because I start to cry.
Right. Yeah. And that happened that's to me hard. In this trial with Joey.
We were lucky on this one though, because she presented through Zoom. So, and the jury was to our right. And she was presenting on a screen to our left. So we got to look at her and not have to look over here.
Right,
we could hide our tears looking away from her. It was good.
She did a great job. Yeah. And she's talking about, you know, how she's 12 years old this time. And then I asked her, you know, why, what about this experience and is sticks with you? And she's talking about how Joey is her hero and how she was there for him at a time where he needed all this help. But now he's there for her in his life. And it was just like, oh my gosh. And then his mom went and she had a completely different experience. And she's telling us about, you know, literally putting him in a wheelchair and you know, taking him to these lectures to go meet these doctors at UCI and USC to see who can give him a chance at
fast forward, this is 2013, 2014, 2015.
Right.
You're 8 years later at this trial. How do you get that amount of future? You had a lot of future damages in this case for him.
Right.
How do you get someone that's out there snowboarding, doing these things to get that type of compensatory?
Yeah. So we leaned all into that. We leaned all into that. And we made that about this underdog story.
Yeah. And, you know, I read something on the way here today that was what did it say? A comeback is stronger than a setback.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that was sort of a theme that I'm not saying that exact thing, but we talked about the David versus Goliath, the comeback. And there was a lot of talk about snowboarding in this case. And in closing, and I told Robbie at some point, like, man, the snowboarding is too much. Like, the jurors don't care about a kid that snowboards. But, and I kept, it's sort of a theme too, where we ask, what does it mean? What's the meaning behind this that is the true heartfelt part? And what Robbie and I had talked about was, it's not about the snowboard. It's about what it means to be able to snowboard from a guy who was about to lose his leg, from a guy who was so dark he wanted to lose his life, from a guy who lost his community and all of his family and friends. And now he's part of this community again, to be back, to have arrived again.
How much time did you guys spend with the plaintiff in this case?
Keep this in mind. This is different. Like, Robbie had been in this case for how long?
3 or 4 months.
3 or 4 months. Right. And in that time, he developed bonds with them. I'd been with Joey for 10 years.
Yeah,
right. So it's why I wanted Robbie to handle the damages, because I felt that was a little too close.
Right? Yeah, I thought that was crazy. When you first told me that, I was like, listen, I'll do whatever you want me to do and help. But I thought that was a little bit crazy.
Well, and that's whatever, you know, we're talking to Gabe, and it was like, you know, this is, you know, you're picking the jury open and closing. Who's the compliment? What's the compliment that you need that might have been missing the first time when you went through this expensive focus group? And it was, just need someone that's like a human being, right? And that's the communication, because that's how you draw it out. You need someone that actually has empathetic care for the plaintiffs to get the story out of them and be able to tell it.
Sure. And I think that early on, you know, Gabe introduced me to Joey. It was a Sunday evening. I remember it was like raining and we were in Huntington Beach. We spent two, three hours with Joey. And it was just this experience where I had an injury when I was young, not anywhere near as serious as Joey's, but I wasn't even going to share this. And Gabe actually brought it forward in our conversation. Gabe's like, you know, Joey, he's not going to bring this up. He's not going to tell you this unless I do. So let me share a little bit about Robbie's history. And you could get
You're welcome, HIPAA.
As soon as he shared that, there was a shift in Joey, in this connection between you and I. He was kind of looking at me like, okay, you get where I'm coming from to some extent.
And you see that? That's 10 years of knowing your client. Yeah. That's 10 years of knowing the case.
And like, you as a trial lawyer. Like, right. Lawyers sometimes feel like they have to do and control everything.
Right.
I think a lot of it is finding compliments that...
And kudos to this guy for giving me that opportunity to build that bond with him. And from there, Joey and I I took the advice that I've learned from Simon Law Group. You know, I'd go visit him. I'd get lunch with him. I wouldn't even talk about trial. Just like, hey, let's go get lunch. Let's just get to know each other more. Spending as much time as I could. And then when you're digging in, because you're asking, okay, how do you, you know, these invisible injuries, how do you get that story out? So now I'm going to his mom and his little sister and his girlfriend and his brother. And all the while, it's kind of a fine balance. So for younger attorneys out there, you know, you want to be cognizant of not over-preparing a witness. And you want it to be natural. And you want to come across as them just telling their story.
Usually, I don't script stuff with the damaged witness. Just get blocks and ask them questions.
Right. That's one of the hardest things for Robbie. I'm telling you. Robbie is a 10-year attorney. Like, he did an amazing job. Yeah. But there was so much throughout the trial. I'm like, get off script.
Just be human.
Right. Be human, have a conversation. Listen to what they're telling you, because they're giving you gems. And if you're on script, you're not going to pick
them. And a lot of times when you hear that gem, repeat it so the juror hears it again. Right?
100%.
Like, jurors like 1, 2, 3s. I like when you ask like one, this thing. Right. I do the top, how would you describe the person before, 3 words and 3 words after.
Right. And just like, right. And for this, I was just trying to keep it shorter. So instead of three, I'm like, just give me one. Give me one good word. But,
and they all write that down. So they're like, what are we gonna do, numbers now?
Right,
I'm
right.
Out. 1, 2.
Right. And I remember, you know, preparing these damages witnesses and talking to them. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where I was just having conversations. And it was so funny, because after the trial, Joey's girlfriend, she was talking to me and she was laughing. And she's like, I thought I had an outline from you. Because she's like, I knew it so well, but it's just because we'd gone through the conversation so many times that she felt fully prepared. And I was like, no, there wasn't. Like, wow. She didn't have an outline. She just, you know, we had talked about it so many times. So
speaking of girlfriends, Robbie doesn't have one. He's single.
Oh, God. There comes the
drop his cell.
Also buy, not coastal.
There's going to be a cell phone number here. Let me
tag onto a point about listening and not being on script. The irony of this is I did close. Robbie did rebuttal on the liability phase. And I told Robbie, he was preparing for rebuttal for a long time. He called me late. He's like, I want to talk about this rebuttal. And I go, Robbie, it's rebuttal. Like, get off the script and just rebut and listen to the key points. And it was the most profound moment of trial, his rebuttal, because he talked about a part where the defense, there's a difference between hearing and listening.
I saw that. It reminded me of the white man can't jump.
Hear Jimmy? That clip.
But it was a rebuttal. It was a true rebuttal where he was pointing at the defense of like, listen, they're not listening. They think they know him. They heard. But the most profound moment was how they treated Joey's mom. And Robbie pulled that out. It was amazing. It was that moment of like, now you're listening.
It was a full circle moment. I appreciate that.
Well, now we got, so, you know, you closed the rebuttal, Gabe, you picked the jury opened. I just want to touch, you know, very briefly on these little things. Picking juries, picking the jury. Mm-hmm. Did you have a jury consultant?
Yes, absolutely. First time I've ever used one and will likely never not use one again.
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of that as well. Like, who'd you use for this draw?
Sonia Chopra, and kudos to Robbie. He found her. We were trying to use Harry Plotkin,
and he was busy. I use Harry for almost every trial too, but he's busy.
And he pointed us over to his protege, Jessica Brilo, who picked up the case very fast, but we couldn't use her. We had already talked to Sonia, and then Sonia became available.
Right.
So then Robbie.
We went with Sonia. And it was a great decision. Like, it took a little bit of time, I feel like, to build that comfort level. But as soon as that comfort level was built, the next day, because it was 2 days of jury selection, the second day of jury selection, I was like, we're good. Like, this is going to be
because I remember really you guys good. Were talking. You felt very comfortable with the jury.
You asked before, difference between phase jury trial one and trial two. No jury consultant, trial one, jury consultant, trial two.
Yeah. What were some... I mean, you know, you're going up against a foreign corporation that Orange County may not feel too keen on, right? I mean, that's probably, you know, the defense is going there. You know, they're going to ring up corporation, Japanese corporation.
Motion in limine, by the way.
Really? Why? But they
couldn't talk about it. They said we don't want to be able to bring in out of state attorneys because most of it, I'm in Florida primarily now, but I'm obviously have my offices here too. But they are national counsel out of Indianapolis and Nashville, so they can't talk about attorneys being out here, but also we don't want you to come in and talk about this being a Japanese corporation and make it nationalistic.
I mean, it seems like a good way for them to get people off for cause if they wanted to. Whatever. I mean, that sounds stupid to me. But did you start to frame some of these issues you knew you were going to be talking about with the emotional injuries? Mm. Like, what are some things? I just wonder what difference things you did this jury selection as opposed to the first one. Any topics that you guys did differently or did things?
Oh. Punitive damages.
Oh, sure. That was big. So the first trial, we were penalized by the jury for not prepping them for phase two. Mm. So when they deliberated for 3 days in the first trial and they fought in the jury room and gave us what they thought was a just verdict. And then I said, okay, you got to come back Monday. And they're like, what the fuck? What do you mean? I thought we're done. So they're like, you just want more money. You're greedy. Mm. So then Robbie and I talked about it. We're like, okay, listen, from the very first minute in voir dire, we're going to say, if you give me permission, we're going to ask for two phases here, but you have to give me permission, but I'm prepping you for this. So we carried that through the whole thing so that even in close, when I closed, I said, I hope this isn't my last time I get to talk to you. I'm going to ask you for permission. Wow. And here's where I'm asking for permission. And then when I got to argue it, I said, remember, I asked you, this is what I was talking
about. That's so, because we're going to skip ahead of the limited time that we have. And by the way, since it's a public proceeding, you know, Gabe has all the transcripts, you could reach out to him. It's public knowledge. He's very open with sharing these things. He has the conglomerate of folks that have been working on these cases for a decade.
They're all public now, They're admitted without protection or protective order, so I can give you actual documents if you need to.
So let's just skip ahead. I want to talk about the moment that most trial lawyers never have in their career. I've tried probably 50 cases. I've never gotten to this phase, the punitive damages phase.
Yeah.
What do you have to prove to get there? How did you get there and what was your argument?
I've been very fortunate. This is my third time arguing punitive damages. Twice in Suzuki, one time on a different case. And they were my last three trials, by the way, in a row.
The Punisher.
You have to establish malice, oppression, and or fraud.
Right. By who?
By a corporate executive, somebody in charge of, somebody speaking on behalf of the corporation itself, not a low-level employee. So an actual officer or director of the corporation has to engage in conduct that amounts to malice, oppression, or fraud. So really the tie-in is that. I mean, you can't just have the salesperson on the lot do something bad to somebody buying a motorcycle. It has to come from Suzuki Corporate. And these documents were easy to establish that. And to the point where we had a document signed by Chairman Suzuki himself that had said this is the owner of the company. And their defense to that was he's not authorized to issue a recall. Right. Like the chairman can't approve a recall. It has to come from a subcommittee. God. And the jury was just like, come on, come on. Really?
Pretty unbelievable.
It was unbelievable. But they did that kind of stuff throughout. It made it easy to hate them for the jury.
So you have this heightened standard.
Yep. And it's got to be done. So here's I stole this from actually. And I steal stuff from everybody, you included. I've stole stuff from you left and right. The man in black I stole from you.
Yeah. Right. And I stole from Nick Rowley. Just put in
flavor. Right. So we steal from each other. Yeah. Right. So at a presentation I went to, he talked about using the terms clear and convincing evidence. Right. So you have to establish with clear and convincing evidence a higher burden, malice, oppression, and fraud. So from the very opening that I did, I said, I'm going to show you with clear and convincing evidence all of the things I'm going to show you about liability. Mm-hmm. I just use the word clear and convincing because people know what the word clear means. People know what the word convincing means. They have no idea what preponderance means. So when I use a clear and convincing, you could see the judge look at me like, dude, what are you doing? And you could see defense go, what are you doing? And I'm like, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Right? Because I'm going to show you with clear evidence and I'm going to show you with convincing evidence that what we're going to show you is right. So when I get to clear and convincing, they're like, I've already heard that.
Standard.
That's a standard.
So now, last, I just want to hear how you got $150 million in punitives.
I asked for it.
That is actually the short answer.
I asked for it.
Yeah. And, you know, a famous mentor of mine said, Gary Dordick said, would you rather have a jury say you asked for too much or you asked for too little?
Right.
Well,
I ask for it.
I believe in options. Right. Yep. And anchoring is a big deal, like anchoring at the right level. Robbie fought with me the night before that I was asking for too little on the compensatory.
Yep.
And he was like, 11's not enough. I want you to ask for 16 or 20.
I said 15.
16 or 20, he said. He didn't say 15.
I'm pretty sure it's 15.
Said 16 or 20. And
yeah,
I said,
I gave you 100% of what you asked for.
More. They gave me 105. They gave me 5,000 more. And I said, Robbie, listen, I don't care if they give me 16 or 20 or 11. I'm asking for punitive damages where it's going to be hundreds of millions, maybe a billion. Mm-hmm. So if I got 16 or 11, doesn't matter to me. I want to get to phase two. Where I was like, I know, but I couldn't sleep tonight if I didn't bring it up. I said, I know what I'm doing. And he goes, I know you know what you're doing. And then afterwards you said, I did the right thing.
Yeah, it was
right?
Good. It was good.
So then I anchored them to their total sales figure. They sell $33.7 billion in sales a year. Comes to $93 million a day. And I said, listen, one day of sales, is that going to punish and or deter their conduct? I said, I don't know. I said, I don't know. I go, I can tell you anything less surely won't. If you give half of that, they make it up by lunch. If you give half of half, they find that in the change in their couch in the lobby.
Right.
Right? So anything less, I go, we got to start out in a day. Right? We got to start out in a day. So that's where we start. And I gave him a good reason for it. And then I took 1% of that number, 33.7 billion. What's 1% of that number? 337 million. And I said, what is 1%? And the defense objected to everything. I couldn't use my PowerPoint. I couldn't use anything.
Just for the listeners, it's kind of shady stuff for another lawyer to do this, but you make, you tell people this is what we're going to do and we're going to do it this way for closing. And then the defense lawyer pulled the rug out from under you and didn't allow you to use the PowerPoint that you created.
Yeah. And they're demonstrative. So I told Robbie from the beginning, it doesn't matter what they do. Yeah. We've already won this case. It doesn't matter what they do. We will be ready for it. We'll be ready to do something about it. So with the 1% issue, I had looked around our courtroom and there were 93 blue stadium chairs in that courtroom, plus the wooden lawyer chairs. That means about 100 chairs. So I planted a chair back by the end where a wooden chair, I planted one back there. And I said, I'm asking for 1%. 1%, what does that look like? I go, and I had a demonstrative that was a 99% blue, 1% red. And it's like, they get to keep all the blue. I go, but let's, and I looked around and I walked to the back of the courtroom and I took a chair out and I put it in the hallway. It was like dead silence. And I walked to the back. I'm like, let me do this. And I took a chair and put it out. I go, there's 100 chairs in this courtroom. And I'm going to remove one. And I did it. I removed 1% of the chairs from this courtroom. Does it feel any different to anybody in here? And a juror, there was three jurors that were like,
Nope.
They nodded nope and wrote it down.
Yeah.
It was right. Brilliant. So 1%, is that going to affect their overall? Is that going to hurt them all that much? That's 337 million. So then I put a billion up, and that's a whole different story. I can talk about that. But then I go, billion's too much. A billion's going to destroy, not deter. Okay. That's good. That's going to be too much. And I knew I'd have an appellate problem if they gave that. So I circled three. I go, 93 is a little too low. 337 is the right number, folks. And I circled it. Mm-hmm. Circled it.
Options.
I was like, this is the right
number. 490 to 330.
That's right. You got
this for a whole day, and I'm sure you're going to get a lot of follow up. So look for him in the news doing those. If you have any other like cases, reach out to Gabe. He'll be more than happy to help you. Guys, thanks for coming on this
Thank
edition
you.
Of the Justice Team Podcast. Just monumental verdict, but more important than anything is the societal good for consumers,
right.
Protecting consumers.
Right.
The more awareness they have about the defective brakes that a lot of people are still out there with right now.
Yeah. Protecting the community, right?
100%.
Yeah.
And let me say, thank you for having me on. And really, I know this isn't a Oscar speech or anything, but thank you to the Simon Group. Without you guys, this case doesn't get done the first time. Doesn't get done the second time because we never make it through the appeal and get remanded back for new trial, and doesn't get done the second time at the level we got it done. So kudos to the Simon Group.
Man. And as we said, the fight is not over because it will continue on this exact case. Thanks, guys, for coming in.
Thanks,
thank you.